I think we'll start. If everyone can mute themselves, that will be the best. Because otherwise we're hearing voices and there's going to be echoes and some other problems. If everyone on Zoom can mute their audio, that will be the best. And if you mute yourself, you can then unmute yourself whenever you wish to. We can mute you from here, but we don't want to be so overbearing. And if you're on the phone, I guess just mute your phone on your own line. But we still hear some people in the background. Okay. So, good Chodesh. Good morning, everybody. Faces and non-faces alike. We'll begin, of course, with the Rishus. Thanks for the Rishus, and thanks in general to Rebbetzin Mandel. Without her, there would not be a Tuesday morning shiur for me to take over in the summers. Likewise, many thanks to Drezel Strauss. Her yearly efforts are very much appreciated, and this year, on top of it all, working with Zoom. There's a hint to the field of Zoom in Eishes Chayil already. Zoma Mosode. She was looking into the field of Zoom. Luckily, I'm not teaching Mishle. That would be not quite the pshat. In any case, many thanks to the Rebbetzin and to Mrs. Strauss, as well as to all the participants. Those I can see and those who I cannot see, everybody is very appreciated. I definitely would not want to give the shiur to myself because I already prepared it. That's when I gave the shiur. It was great. But if I have to say it over, it's thanks to you, the audience. That's the best. And also, we want to thank the sisterhood and Mrs. Tova Cohn. I neglected to thank her on Friday when I gave the sisterhood shiur, but it's not only that, it's the idea behind all Lady Shiurim. We thank her and we appreciate it very much. So, I should note that this shiur, every week is definitely a standalone shiur. You don't need to have heard last week's shiur or last year's shiur, but we should note this is a continuation of Pirkei Avos, where you and I left off at the end of last summer. We were in the middle of Perek Dalet. We'll get inside in a few minutes. But I figured we probably should review a little bit the Hakdama of what Pirkei Avos is about, because I don't really expect you to have memorized it a year ago. By the way, also, the shiurim from last year, in case anyone wants to match up the prakim of what we're saying every week, they are up on the KJ website. If anybody wishes to review, they're up there. So, to run through, perhaps a little bit quicker than we did last year, but just to explain, what is Avos? Where is it from? What is it? Avos is, as we may know, the ninth of the 10 Mesechtos, which are in Seder Nezikin. Nezikin, we usually think of damages and torts and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, legal issues. Avos is there too. And Avos, in fact, is also mentioned in Bava Kamma as one of the opinions of what one should concentrate learning on if one wants to become a Lemehve Chasida, to become a Chasid. That doesn't mean to go out and buy a Shtreimel, but it means to become a very, very good, pious person. So one of the suggestions over there is he should learn Milei Do'avos, one should learn Midos and improve oneself. And as to why Avos is called Avos, it's an unusual name. We usually name Mesechtas after their content, generally speaking. Rosh Hashanah, Shabbos, Psochim, Sanhedrin is about the Sanhedrin, etc., etc., Brachos, the Tefillah, Brachos. I'm sorry? So, Pirkei Avos, it's not a parakim about fathers necessarily, although Father's Day was yesterday, but it probably was not written for them. So some suggestions are made. The Rambam says teachers themselves, Rebbeim, Torah teachers, are called Avos. As famously, Elisha calls Eliyahu, Avi, Avi, Rechav Yisrael, Ufarashav. He refers to Eliyahu, his great teacher, as my father. So this is all about the teachers teaching, and that would be called Avos. Some other suggestions are it refers to the Kadmus, the precedence. We're still hearing some voices in the background. Unless you're talking to me, which I don't know, you need to mute yourself.
You know who that is? That's where the parents are divorced. Her mother is
I think somebody needs to mute their phone, otherwise we mute you. I don't want to compete because it might be somebody talking to me. Okay, if that was not part...
Rabbi Schuler from the outside...
Who is on the phone? Mute your phone.
Huh? What happened?
Mute your phone.
Huh? Talking to somebody who's zooming in and she's saying, use your phone.
Okay. You're supposed to mute your phone. Put your phone on mute.
All right. So, ovos can also refer to the Kadima that Derech Eretz Kadma.
Every summer, she
puts it in the medicine. Please mute your phone.
Make a difference, but the fact is she can do it. This
one. Okay. Everyone is welcome to unmute themselves if they would like to participate. The problem is I always assume somebody is participating and then I'm not sure what I'm hearing. But if you have something to add, we would love to hear it. In any case, Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah, so a parent comes before a child. There's that idea of Ovos. This is all about Midos and Derech Eretz. It must precede the actual Torah. And possibly, this I didn't see inside, but it might be a possibility, and it certainly is true, and it's to note, because in Perkei Ovos we simply state sayings, much more than sayings, Torah teachings by various Tanoim, we actually get to hear from some of the very early Tanoim, who we might not have heard their names ever otherwise, because in all other Masechtas, if you're telling me a halacha, unless there's some machlokas, you don't need to say someone's name. You just say, on Shabbos, you can't do XYZ. If there's a machlokas, which happened later among the Tanoim, then you say, Beis Shammai says you cannot do this, Beis Hillel says you can. But in terms of Avos, there's no machlokas at all. And yet, we attribute all the different memras, all the different sayings, to their each individual chacham who said them. So we do hear of some of the more early Tanoim who we might not otherwise have heard from. Speaking of when and where, we should note, Tanoim run about a 500-year period. Since we got through about 3.5 parakim last year, we are now holding towards the later part of the Tanaic period, and this parak will have some later Tanoim. The last two parakim, in fact, will not have so many names of Tanoim at all. And by the way, as to why Perkei Ovos got instituted as to be said on Shabbos afternoons, so the idea to say Perkei Ovos between Pesach and Shavuos is already mentioned by the Gaonim. That's nearly 2,000 years ago by now. They said Perkei Ovos. The extension that most shuls extended all the way through Rosh Hashanah, and we only through Shavuos B'Tammuz, but we all extended past Shavuos, seems to have been a later date invention. And the idea behind it seems to be summer afternoons are very long. They can lead to perhaps not the best kind of content which you fill your hours with, so it was felt that very appropriate to keep on saying Perkei Ovos. But the real idea was between Pesach and Shavuos to prepare oneself for Matan Torah, a perek a week, with the very last perek, we'll see it in Mitzvah Shem, we'll see it in a few weeks, called Perek Kinyan HaTorah. It's very appropriate for the Shabbos right before Shavuos. But as we said, it certainly can't hurt to go on. Obviously, Shavuos is not the end date of Matan Torah, Chas V'Shalom, it's just the beginning. Okay. I think that's pretty much the Hagdama. Anyone who wants to hear more details is welcome to review last year's. So, ladies and anybody else on the screen, we are up to, in our Perkei Ovos, we're in the middle of Perek Dalid, and we were holding by what in your Sidurim should be called Mishneh Chof Gimel, 23. On the Rödelheim, the Siddur that I have, it's on page 162 towards the bottom, but I know they're different paginations. Again, Perek Dalid, the fourth Perek, Mishnah Chaf Gimel, 23. I should note at this point, well, first of all, I'll again note, anybody who has a comment or a question, please feel free to unmute. We did not mean to, keep everybody silent over there, Chas V'Shalom. But additionally, I should also note that the Sidurim, for reasons which are not quite apparent, have subdivided some of the Mishnayos. What we call the various Mishnos in a Siddur, not all of them actually appear as separate new Mishnayos in a Mishnayos. So, even though the Prokim look quite long, we have 29 Mishnayos in this Perek, the numbering is not really Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, and it's not even Halacha L'Rabbeinu HaKadosh or anything like that. I'm not quite sure why Sidurim did that. It maybe just made it more manageable to have smaller chunks, I'm not sure. In a real Mishnayos, this would actually be Mishnah 18. But in your Sidurim, again, it should be Chaf Gimel 23. And we'll begin with, again, one of the later Tanoim. His name is Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar was a Talmid of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir being the wife of Beruria. He is somewhat famous for that. Rabbi Meir, who we say, Elokah de Meir Aneni, very, very, one of the greatest Tanoim. This was one of his students. So let's see what he has to say. Chaf Gimel. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Al teratza es chavercha, v'sha'as kaso. Do not seek to appease your friend at the time of his anger. Ve'al tenachamehu, do not seek to comfort him, v'sha'as shemeso mutol lefonov, at the time when he's dead, when the one who he's mourning over is lying in front of him still. Ve'al tish'al lo, v'sha'as nidro, do not ask a shayla for him, meaning to be matir neder, just at the time that he made his neder, he made a vow, for better or for worse, whether he should have, we'll see. Ba'al tishtadeler oso, b'sha'as kalkol oso. And do not attempt to see him at the time of his disgrace. He's just had some kind of embarrassment, don't try to seek him out then. So, we'll go through the different points that this Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar is making. He first said, don't try to appease your friend at the time of his great anger. It's never a good idea. And the Svarno explains, because whatever you say to him, the guy's reactions will be almost instinctive. I think all of us feel this very much. If we're really upset, we shouldn't be, but if we're very upset about something, whatever we say is not well thought out. And when somebody tries to say, oh, you know, it's really not so terrible, think about this and that, and maybe you should do this and that, whatever we respond is probably not going to be coming from a logical place. It's just we don't want to hear it. We respond something, I don't even want to think about it. He cannot be mekabel from you at that point, so there's really no point in engaging with him. You will certainly not make him feel better. And the Rabbeinu Yonah notes that you will cause him to say harsh words. You'll cause him to yell back at you. You'll cause him to not only be angry, but to be angry at you, because he doesn't want you getting involved. Then we end, by the way, the Gemara says we can actually learn this from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. After the Chet HaEgel, Hashem had listened to Moshe, Moshe had davened, and Hashem was listening. He was going to continue with Bnei Yisrael, not to give up on them. And then he said, Panaye lechu v'ani chosi lach. My countenance will go, and I will lead you, or I will be with you, something positive. So the Gemara reads it a way of panim can sometimes mean panim shel zaam, an angry appearance. The opposite of yoyer Hashem panav elecha, but sometimes it can be an angry thing. So Gemara says, panaye lechu. Wait for my panim zumos, wait for my anger to leave, and then we'll continue on together. So it's a limit to wait for somebody to get out of his most burning anger, and then we can discuss, then we can continue. Then the Mishnah continues, don't try to comfort somebody when they're dead is still right in front of them. So Rabbeinu Yonah says it's the same idea as he had said by the one who's upset. Over here, if somebody tries to say Tanchumin to somebody who's just experienced a loss, it might, Chas V'Shalom, lead to that person to say something not correct, Klapei Malo, or in general, if somebody tries to say, you know, it's really not so terrible, he'll say it's very, very terrible, and he might speak out something that he wishes he would not have ever said. And some other Mefarshim say this actually is a continuation of the idea of the kaas. Don't try to appease someone when he's very angry, because in his view of things, he's that angry, it's as if it's like he has somebody dead in front of him. He's so furious, he's so unconsolable at that moment that there's really no point in there's no point in discussing it with him at that moment. Okay. And the Rav and the Gra actually bring also a remez to this in Navi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or Yirmiyahu HaNavi, speaking in Hashem's name, speaking about the terrible Chorban that is coming, will have come, because Bnei Yisrael, unfortunately, were not mending their ways. So Hashem says, in general, or Chazal take it as if he's speaking to his Malachim, Al to'itzu l'nachameini, do not hurry to comfort me. Meaning, it's Hashem himself, obviously, who brought about the decree. It's a kavachoma for a person who didn't even choose whatever happened to him. Hashem chose this. Hashem knew it had to be. And yet he says, I am very distraught over this. I'm very upset. I had to cause a chorban to my children. So don't rush. Don't rush for the comforts. You malachim, right? We know, everybody knows it's a tova. But don't rush to comfort me. It's at b'shas a chorban, it's terrible. It's like a meso mutolafonov. And in fact, actually, that lashon of shemeso mutolafonov is used actually about the Seudah Mafsekes on Erev Tisha B'Av. We are to view that as a meso mutolafonov of the Aleinu, like an owning. Somebody has to take care of a very serious loss. Okay, continuing. Do not ask a shayla for him when he has just made a neder. So, this tish'alo, ask a shayla, means don't try to be matir neder for him. As we know, nedarim are never such a good idea. Under most circumstances, they're a rather poor idea. And that's why we say b'li neder. We say it's a kabbalah, whatever, but b'li neder. So if somebody does make a neder, you might want to promptly find them a pesach, as we call it, an opening for the chacham to be able to say, but had you known XYZ, you surely would not have made this neder, right? Just as a very silly example, had you known that your mother was coming and she loves cheesecake, you never would have made a neder, I'm never going to bake cheesecake again. Whatever the circumstance is, you can come up with much better ones, I'm sure. But if you ask a person that, and obviously the neder in question is probably not about cheesecake, it's about something he's angry about, he's upset about, I'll never do whatever. If you try to find all those psochim right now when he's angry, he's going to say, oh yes, I did mean it, even that, even because of that, even with that, even with that, yes, 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 I mean it. So that in 3 days, or 1 day, or half an hour from now, when he comes down and he says, oh gosh, I better go to the Rav, let's hope he can find a pesach for me, you, the person who's gotten involved, will have precluded any psochim from being found, because the guy will have to say, no, I included this in my neder, I included that, I included that. It's going to be a much harder job for the Rav, who wants to finally be matir neder for him. That's the general pshat of this section of the Mishnah. I saw two other ideas also brought by Rashi. One saying, Al tish'al, don't ask of him to do his neder that quickly. We know in general there's definitely a halacha, bal ta'acher. A person should not delay his neder. This is talking about tzedakah or kabanos, that sort of thing. If you promise something, don't delay. But it's a fine line. You also can't push somebody the moment he spoke. No, I'm the gabe, you know, where's the money? Where's the money? You can't do that either, so al tish'alo b'shas nidro, don't immediately jump on him. That's not acceptable. And finally, interesting shot also, let's say if the person who has this neder is a Talmud Chacham, he's someone who perhaps could be matter for you, or as a general idea, don't go to him to help you if he has the same problem. Meaning, if he made a neder about XYZ, he's suffering under it. So don't come over to him and say, oh, could you be matir me? I really didn't mean it so much. Can you help me out? He has the same problem himself. So that's not courteous. You probably also won't get good results because he'll be annoyed and, you know, say, well, I have this problem. I should help you. Not a good idea. You'll just kind of rub salt in his wounds. The whole Mishnah is of that idea, obviously. Not the opposite of how to do things b'derech eretz and with wisdom. It's you're pushing somebody, you're rubbing salt in their wounds. And that's the idea of the last one also. If somebody just suffered a reverse, an embarrassment, a shame, something like that, now is really not the time to pay a bezuch and to say, ah, nice to see you, so nice. Probably the wrong time for that. And the Gra and the Rav again bring down an example for that from the Torah. Actually, very early on in the Torah, they point out that when Adam and Chava had sinned by the Eitz Hadas, the one mitzvah they had, and Chaval, they blew it. So it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to them in the garden, but he did so after already Vayisbru Lahem Alei Te'ena Vayasu Lem Chagoros. Hashem waited for them to make themselves some sort of primitive clothing or coverings. Up to that point, they hadn't needed them because they hadn't done a chait and it wasn't an issue, they weren't embarrassed, etc. But now they were very ashamed. They were ashamed of the chait they had done, and along with that, because of that, they were ashamed of their lack of clothing. So Hashem did not appear to them, and again, this is Hashem who sees everything, who is everywhere, but he didn't show himself, he didn't appear to them until they were in a more seemly condition. So kav v'chomer to us, who are not all over the place, we don't have to constantly be seen, appear to people, we shouldn't go over to people who are in a embarrassed condition. Okay, so that was Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Now we come to the next Mishnah. In your Sidurim, it's hopefully called Chaf Dalid 24. In the Mishnayos would be 19, your Tess. It's a very interesting Mishnah. First of all, we should find out a little bit about the author of this Mishnah, the Tana, whose name Shmuel HaKotan. Shmuel the Minor, the small Shmuel. So this is by no means a title of lack of respect, the little Shmuel. Shmulek, definitely not. Chas v'shalom. We know actually a lot of Mechabrim sign their works as such. Yitzchak HaKotan, Meir HaKotan. That's a sign of Anova, that they chose to sign their own works instead of writing Harav HaGadol, whatever, Meir. They obviously wouldn't do that. When they sign their own works, they write Yitzchak HaKotan, the small, the minor, whatever his name is. Over here, though, we can't quite explain it that way because people are calling him that. That was his well-known title. Shmuel HaKotan. It can't be that he quickly wrote it in before they published. He added HaKotan. That doesn't sound right. So they explain, actually, that Shmuel HaKotan Bedoro was the greatest of the great. In fact, the Chachamim were sitting once together in Yavne, and a bas kol came out and said, the Shechina would be roi to dwell on one of you, except that the door is not so worthy. And they all looked at Shmuel HaKotan. They knew whom the bas kol was referring to. And they, in fact, when he was nifter, they mourned for him, thus they mentioned this. And also, interestingly enough, when Shmuel HaKotan was nifter, he seems to have had some sort of Ruach HaKodesh, because he predicted, unfortunately, a lot of the coming Chorban. He predicted some of the Asara Haruge Malchus, and different terrible things that were going to come. Even in our days, we know some of the Gedolim had terrible, terrible premonitions, like before the war, the Chavetz Chaim, very famously, different things like that. So why is he called Shmuel HaKotan? After all we've said, he's definitely not HaKotan. So they say he was called Shmuel HaKotan, as in the only one greater than him, perhaps, would have been Shmuel HaNovi. Compared to Shmuel HaNovi, okay, we grant he's Shmuel HaKotan. Meaning he's in the same league. He's in the same league as Shmuel HaNovi, but, you know, when we compare the two, okay, Shmuel HaNovi's probably the bigger one, he's Shmuel HaKotan. So it's a very, very big compliment. Now, the interesting thing about this Mishnah is, as we say, ain't a Mishnah. That's, usually we mean there's some mistake. Over here, there's no mistake at all. The Mishnah stands, but the problem is, if you had a very good knowledge of Tanakh, which perhaps some of you already recognized, this entire Mishnah that he says is two psukim from Mishlei, with absolutely no additional words, nothing. He's quoting you Mishlei. So we'll read it. Shmuel HaKotan Omer. Shmuel HaKotan says, "Benfol oyivcha al tismach, when your enemy falls, do not be happy. Uvkashlo, and when he stumbles, al yogeli becha, let your heart not rejoice. Hen yireh Hashem, lest Hashem see that v'rabeinov, it will be bad in his eyes. Beheshiv may Allah apo, and he will take back from upon him his wrath." Meaning, how did this enemy stumble? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was angry at him and he made him stumble. However, if you then become all overjoyed about this for your own ulterior motives, so Hashem may take that back and say, well, you know what, you don't look much better than him, you're so happy, so let's put him back where he was. So the question is, why is this a Mishnah? Surely all the Tanoim quoted Tanakh quite a bit. But we don't attribute most of Tanakh as Tanoim statements. This is Mishlei Perek Chav Dalid, Psukim Yud Zayin to Yud Ches. You can check it out. There's no extra word. It's two Psukim from Mishlei. So the Mefarshim explained that it must be that Shmuel HaKatan used to quote these psukim and darshan them and use them to be machiach people all the time. And when they thought of Shmuel HaKatan's, what sort of a midah was Shmuel HaKatan trying to teach them, it was exactly this. And apparently both he and the redactors of the Mishnah felt it was just best to put it exactly the way the pasuk said it, because that's really saying it the best way it could be said. So it's attributed to Shmuel HaKatan, but obviously not as his own invention. It's the psukim that he is mentioning from Mishle. Now, we should discuss it a little bit as to how we reconcile this pasuk, these psukim, with the idea of Ba'avod Rishoyim Rina. When your enemy, we presume, is a Rasha, we're obviously not speaking about poor Midos of somebody who just hates people for no reason, sinasinam, jealousy, etc. That's a different story. Here we assume an Oyev is somebody who, you know, deserves to be your enemy. It's somebody who's caused you problems, somebody's a Rasha, whatever it is. So we do have this concept of Avod Rishoyim Rina. When Rishoyim are gotten out of this world, there's Rina, there's joy, there's rejoicing. We say Hallel because of Mitzrayim. It's true, we also say half Hallel because the Mitzrayim drowned. So we see there's this kind of tension between what is it? Are we not supposed to rejoice, or are we supposed to rejoice? We in Pesach, we do. We tamp it down. We don't say the full Hallel, but we definitely rejoice. Whereas Hashem told his Malachim, why are you saying Shira at all? My creatures are drowning in the sea and you're saying Shira? That's not acceptable at all. So where exactly do we stand on all this? So the Mefarshim seem to all take it as such Rina, Ba'avod Rishoyim Rina, is only acceptable at all if and only if it can be done from a truly L'Shem Shamayim perspective. If you are truly happy to hear that this Russia was causing so much trouble is gone because, Baruch Hashem, now there will be more Kavod Shamayim, now there will not be Chil Hashem, now people will be allowed to do mitzvot, etc., etc., that's okay. But if any sort of your own views and personal animosity gets mixed in, so that's already not acceptable. And it's certainly not acceptable if you're mostly happy just because he bothered you so there he goes. That's if it's a personal lolishma type of thing, one has to be very careful. One can be grateful, now I won't be bothered by him anymore. Baruch Hashem, it's okay, good. But to be happy, to have that schadenfreude, to be really happy, now he's getting it, that's not okay. And we know in Chazal, different memories are brought down of how, in fact, in such situations, it is always better if that person can fix himself, can do tshuva. Why should somebody who's bothering me have to be destroyed? Let him rather stop bothering me and, behave himself and not be a problem anymore. And...
Are you wrong with it?
What?
Oh, yes. I want to ask Rachel something.
Yes, ma'am.
Where is Rachel?
I'm here.
I want to ask her a question.
You might have to scroll, but I'm here. I'm listening to you.
Okay. I want to ask you, in Yeshayahu with Moab, when the Jews, are fighting Moab, when Moab comes, he feels sorry for Moab, and he cries for Moab. So I don't quite understand that. This is an enemy of Klal Yisrael, and yet Yeshayahu is crying for Moab. So I think it's in chapter, I don't remember which chapter, maybe 17 or 18. So how do you resolve that with what is said here?
I mean, with what
enemy falls?
With what is said over
feels bad for Moab.
With what is said over here, it fits very well. I'm trying to reconcile with the other side of the coin of sometimes one should be happy when an enemy falls. What you're telling me in Yeshaya, I would have to look up, but...
The opposite, that Yeshayahu feels sympathy or cries for Moab.
I don't know if sympathy is the best word. He's probably... I would have to look at it, but...
Not the best word, but he cries for Moab.
I would have to look at it, but most likely a Navi is speaking in the name of Hashem. It would be something like we said about Mitzrayim. Hashem says, you're happy, my Masa Yodai Tovim Bayom. We're never rejoicing when Hashem's creatures that he chose to create individually, each human being, they're gone. That's never a happy occasion. I mean, that's what we're speaking about over here. You're right. The memra over here that Shmuel HaKatan says would fit well with Yeshayahu. I would have to look at Yeshayahu, but something along those lines would fit very well. The question is, what do we do with... we do celebrate Pesach, obviously, not only because of our redemption. We also definitely stress the Mitzrayim got what was coming to them. And again, Ba'avod Rishoyim Rina, there's a concept of the world definitely does better when Rishoyim are out of there. Although, as we said again, the Rishoyim themselves generally have a choice. Do they want that Ba'avod Rishoyim to be as in they cease being Rishoyim and they become more decent people? Or do they cease being? They're still Rishoyim, but they cease being. So that's their Bechira Chavshis, that's the choice they make. Whether we have to be so thrilled that they made the wrong choice and are now destroyed. By Pesach, by the way, maybe this will answer you also. By Pesach, one of the answers given to distinguish why we were allowed to say Shira, we said Oz Yashir. To this day, we minimize it a little bit. We don't say full Hallel, but we say Hallel. We say Hallel by the Seder. We say Shirim Shishbachos. And again, Al Hayom. We said Shira Hayom. Whereas the Malachim were apparently hushed immediately. You're saying Shira. So one answer given over there is, we were the victims. Somebody who is no geya to it, who truly suffered, is, in the sense of being grateful to Hashem, allowed to be grateful and say Shira. Not in the haha, they're getting it, but we experience suffering, we have what to be grateful to, from our perspective. But the Malachim didn't have either. Malachim were just praising Hashem that, look, you destroy Rishayim, look at all those people drowning. So Hashem said that he didn't want to hear. They're my creations. You think I'm happy, I need you to tell me, hey, look, you destroyed them, that's not so suitable. I mean, again, what it means, Malachim altogether, Malachim don't have free will, there's a lot of questions to be asked on all of these memories, but I think somewhere along those lines, we certainly can understand that a Navi, especially speaking in the name of Hashem, would definitely feel regret and perhaps cry over the loss of a whole nation or a whole nation's army. And again, you're right, there's a spectrum over here. We seem to be saying even individually, even the person who perhaps has suffered should not rejoice unless only if and only if he truly knows it's Lishma, but if there's any personal animosity, he should not. And in general, when Chal Yisrael have a victory over an enemy, I mean, yes, L'achris Hayomim, you know, Mitzvah Shem, some of those Umos will not have to be destroyed, they will perhaps become good people. But other ones will be destroyed, and it will certainly be a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, that we can certainly fully say. A cute marshal is given, how do you distinguish between whether you're truly happy al kiddush shem shamayim or, you know, pretty good, something's happening to them. So they say, you think about a housewife and a cat, they both would tell you, we hate mice. No housewife wants to see a mouse, and cats are generally not great friends with mice either. What's the difference, though? The housewife would be much happier if she never had to deal with a mouse again. Just leave my house, I'll be here, and I will never have to deal with this mouse again, and I would have a very much pleasanter life. The cat, though, would be miserable. He hates mice, but he wants to get the next one. He wants to see the next one. He doesn't want there to be no mice. He wants to have a good time with them. He hates them. Yeah, sure, he eats them. Okay, but he enjoys their being there. So the nimshal is, when we speak about something not acceptable going on, if we are truly Lashma, we would be much, much happier if it would be solved, if it would be done with, gone, in any way. If such people would just stop their behavior, that would be fine. If Hashem would intervene, that would be great. Anything, let the issue not be there. Somebody who's not so Lashma would be very happy. Ah, see, he's getting it. Ah, you see, he's doing it again. And now we can really chatten. I warned him once. Ah, now I can punish him. That's already a little bit, quite of a different level, and that's perhaps somewhere along these lines that we're speaking about. Also, the Rav, the Bartanura, also says that if you rejoice, like in the sense of, he's getting that, you know, I said he needs that punishment, he's getting it now, there's a little bit of a chutzpah from you in your regard of Hashem. You're almost making him as if, like, Hashem is your shaliach, he's doing what you wanted. But we dive into Hashem, we say, Hashem, help me, please, I need help from this person, whatever, fine. But Hashem's actions are from Hashem. They're not done as your shaliach. I wanted to get back at him, and see, you know, I sicked Hashem on him. Chas v'shalom. First of all, it's a very wrong thing to do, to ever ask Hashem to punish someone. You just ask for Yeshua, whatever you need. And it's really almost like a chutzpah to say, right, Hashem did it. I called it. I punished you. That's a very wrong way to think. And again, along the lines, I guess, of what Mrs. Adler was asking, and in general, we certainly have the concept we should try to emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Hashem famously says over and over, Ki lo echpos b'mos ha-meis, we read this in Yom Narayim, and other times, Hashem would, again, much, much rather prefer that the Rasha fix his ways and remain. Ki im b'shuvo midarkal v'chaya. shuvu, rather return and acquire for yourself new life. So there's certainly there should be no joy in seeing the defeat. There might be gratitude or b'avod Hashem rina in the sense of kiddush Hashem, baruch Hashem, it's finally over and now things are better. But more than that is really what Shmuel HaKatan is warning us about. So I mean, again, these psukim are in Mishlei, ayein sham. There certainly is surely, you know, the discussion can be almost unending, but that's the basic idea, I think. Our next Mishnah has a very interesting author, and this is Elisha ben Avuya, more commonly known as Acher. So he definitely needs a hagdama before we read what he has to say, because Elisha ben Avuya, to put it mildly, is not called Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya. And to put it more than mildly, he's generally known as Acher, the other. Like, we don't want to say his name. Like, another one of our favorite characters we call Oso Ha'ish, that guy. We don't like to say his name. There's more of a problem, perhaps, with one of the names is Mashiach in Greek, so we don't want to give him that title. But the other name, you know, we'd rather not deal with it. Oso Ha'ish, that fellow. So this person, Elisha ben Avuya, who started off life in a much better position than our other dear friend, also ends up being called Acher, the other one, we don't want to deal with him. He ended up as a kofer, unfortunately. So we'll give some background information, it's kedai, it's very interesting to hear a little bit about it. We also should mention that Acher, when he was known as Elisha ben Avuya, was the Rebbe of Rabbi Meir. We had Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, who was a student of Rabbi Meir. Well, over here, we have someone who was the teacher of Rabbi Meir. You'd have to be pretty special to be the teacher of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was one of the great Tanoim. And not only that, but Rabbi Meir didn't even stop learning from him, even after Elisha ben Avuya had become Acher, had gone off, as we call it today. In fact, the story is brought in the Gemara that Acher was riding a horse on Yom Kippur, which fell on a Shabbos, so, you know, you can count up the chatos, what you're doing wrong. And Rabbi Meir was walking along with him, hearing a lecture from him, and Acher told Rabbi Meir, "Well, stop, we're getting to Tichum, you can't walk any further." So, incredible. I think perhaps what's even sad is that today we wouldn't even find it so incredible, right? You know, Elu ve'elu, very nice, they won't meet. That's not acceptable. Back then, this would be unheard of. You're walking with somebody who's not keeping Shabbos, and he's warning you, but be careful, remember, you know, you hold of Tichum, stop over there. So there's a great discussion of how could Rabbi Meir possibly have continued learning from Acher. In fact, Rabbi Meir a bit suffered from it too. There are some Mishnayos which are not named in the name Rabbi Meir because he had to do with Acher. So, not to blame, but it wasn't such a great thing. I mean, the answer is how he could do it was because Rabbi Meir was, in his own right, already a very great scholar. He was an adult. He was not somebody who would probably be led astray by Elisha ben Avuya. But for most of us, certainly obviously for a child, and I'm sure for all of us too, we probably should stick with the Mishnah we had much earlier, Al Tamin Ba'atzmacha Ad Yom Mosecha, never rely on yourself, and if you're looking around for a Torah teacher, probably Acher is not the one to go to. But in any case, a little bit of a background is brought by the Yerushalmi, some things which perhaps contributed to Elisha ben Avuya's eventual fall from grace. They say his mother, actually, while she was pregnant with him, smelled Avodah Zorah, a beautiful incense of Avodah Zorah, and somehow it made its way in to her womb. This is, again, not anything that one could blame. It's just mentioning it. I guess it's, you know, to learn from the opposite, it's very nice to try to keep oneself far from such wrong things when imparting chinuch to kids, I guess even unborn kids, but certainly born children. And similarly, a little bit later on, when Elisha was about to be named at his bris, when the baby Ben Avuya was at his bris, so his father Avuya had invited all the Gedolei Yerushalayim, they were a prominent family in Yerushalayim, and while the guests were, I don't know, probably waiting for the Seuda or something like that, this Avuya, the father, noticed that Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, who were the two Gedolei Hador whom he had invited, were learning Torah themselves, you know, like at a chuppah, you see everybody schmoozing or whatever, and the Rabbanim are learning Gemara. So these two Gedolim were learning. They were learning with such a koach that there were flames surrounding them. So Avuya, who was, I guess, on the level to even see this, asked them, "Gentlemen, you came to burn down my house? What's up with that?" So they said, no, don't worry about it. We're just learning like how Torah was given in fire by Sinai. So if you learn it with a total proper intensity, you'll get fire again. And in a good sense, there's nothing to worry about. So Avuya was very, very impressed. And he said, you know what, if this is what people who learn Torah get, they can look like they're these, incredible flame throwers. So I'll dedicate my little baby son to Torah. We'll name him Elisha, and he'll be dedicated to Torah. And so it was. He sent him to the proper yeshivas. He grew up. He was going to be a rabbi. But it was very much done shelo lishma. Avuya apparently was only impressed by what he saw, not like by the ideas behind it, like, you know, this is Torah. And his dedication was not completely lishma. Then we also come to the famous stories of what more immediately caused Acher to go off, and I say caused with some caution, as we'll see. But what did he see? So I think we're familiar with some ideas. One story is, one masa is that Elisha ben Avuya, a.k.a. Acher, once saw a father tell a son, please go up this ladder and do shluach hakein for me. I can't go up the ladder, please do it, bring me back the eggs. The kid went up. He brought the eggs, but on his way down, unfortunately, it was a high ladder. The ladder slipped, and the kid died. So these two mitzvos, as we know, are the two mitzvos that say Laman Yarichun Yomecho, that's Kibbur Avayim, and V'harachta Yomim, that's about Shluach HaKein. So Elisha ben Avuya saw this frightening sight, and he said, "That's Arichus Yomim. This kid just did these two mitzvos. I don't know if he was a kid, maybe he was a grown up, whatever. The son of this father, he just did this, and he died. That's terrible." The funny thing is, the Gemara also brings this as a simple question. What does the man Yarichun Yomecha mean? The Gemara doesn't shy away from questions either. This whole story with Elisha ben Avuya comes in because the Gemara Taka is asking this. What does it mean, the man Yarichun Yomecha? Somebody indeed could just do that, and it's his luck, and he goes, and he slips, and he dies. So what's the man Yarichun Yomecha? So a very simple answer, which I think most of us probably know already. The man Yarichun Yomecha means Yom Shekulu Aruch. We're referring to Chaye Olam Haba. No matter how long and how nice you live in this world, at the end, there's not life. At the end, there's an end. So, Man Yarichun Yomecha doesn't even really apply to this world. It would mostly apply to Olam Haba. And the irony of this is that the person who explains this in the Gemara is somebody named Rabbi Yaakov, who is the grandson of Acher. So, his own grandfather was misled by this, or at least used it along the path of his going astray, and his own grandson, this Rabbi Yaakov, was the son of a daughter of Acher, explained it very properly the way we usually explain it without any problems. Another thing that's brought is Acher saw the tongue of either Rabbi Chutzpis HaMeturgeman, that's one of the Asara Ruge Malchus, or some other Gersos have Rabbi Yehuda HaNachtum, who is not mentioned generally, but unfortunately the martyrs in the Roman ages are probably more than we have any idea of. The Asara Ruge Malchus are mentioned as the one klal, but there were many, many, many more. We know the walls of Yerushalayim were surrounded by all the martyred Yidden, etc. So, think about Beitar, all these things. So, Acher saw the tongue of one of either Rabbi Chutzpis HaMeturgeman or Rabbi Yehuda HaNachtum being schlepped around in the mouth of a pig. He had been dismembered or something like that. So he was very, very disheartened and shaken, and also went off. And probably the famous, the most famous that we may think of is the very famous story from Gemara Chagiga, which is that Arba'a Nichnasu L'Pardes. Four great Gedolim entered the Pardes, which literally is translated as the orchard. But as we know, Pardes is a nutrikon, Pei is Pshat, Reish is Remez, Dalet is Darash, and most importantly, the Samach, Pardes, is Sod. So Pardes usually refers to Chochmas HaNistor. They in some sense went up to Shamayim. Tosfos says not literally, they said a shame, they saw some sort of vision. They delved into Kabbalah, we would say, on a very, very high level, not in the Kabbalah Center downtown, Chas V'Sholom, on a very, very real and high level. And not all of them made it out okay. Rabbi Akiva is the one who went in B'Shalom, went out B'Shalom, and Rabbi Akiva's student is a B'Shem Ben Yochai, right? So he was okay with Kabbalah. He was on the right level. Ben Zoma went in and unfortunately lost some of his seichel. He was never completely normal after that. Ben Azai went in and died young. I mean, not at that point, but he did not live a long life. That's why Ben Zoma and Ben Azza actually both died relatively young and did not get smicho. That's why they're just called Ben Zoma, Ben Azza. Their first names were Shimon. And the last one, or I don't know the last one, but the fourth one to go in was Acher, and he went in, and the Gemara's Lashon is he went into this orchard, because that's what a paradise means, and instead of, you know, admiring the trees or whatever else you should do in the botanical gardens in the orchard, Kitzetz Netios, he chopped down the saplings. He behaved completely wrong. He saw things which he did not understand. He saw things in Shamayim, and he said, what's going on? They're different Rishuyos, I'm seeing different Malachim. He totally took it the wrong way. I guess he should not have gone in there, and he went off. However, I think it's very, very important to note at this point, we mentioned three different things, or maybe even more things, that perhaps led to his going off, but the Gemara itself points out, Tina Haya Belibo. He had problems. He was not doing things right to begin with. The Gemara says, Lo pasak shir yevoni misfosov. Greek songs never ceased from his lips. He was involved in things he should not have been involved in. When he stood up from the Beis Medrash, there were sifrei minim, there were apikarzisho books that would fall out of his robes when he was trying to stand up from learning. Oops, drop this, drop that. So, all of these events that we mentioned may indeed have been like the last thing. Okay, forget it, I'm going. But there were problems to begin with. And this fits very, very well with, in our more recent days, what we've seen, whether it was Reform or more recently, whatever, as one of our Gedolim very famously said, I can attempt to answer any question, but I cannot answer answers. If you're coming to me with all your questions and shaylos because really you're already interested in something else, you're not interested in Torah anymore, so I can't answer you. And that seems to have been something along the lines of Acher also. And later on, we know very famously, Acher seemed to, thought he heard, or did hear, Shuvu banim shovivim, many psukim call out, Bnei Yisrael, return to me, all you lost children. And then he heard, Chutz me Acher, with the exception of Acher. So he felt Teshuva was totally gone, he didn't have that option of Teshuva. And therefore, he just kept on doing worse and worse averos. He was basically an apikoros, and that was his life. He was wrong, it happens to be. Even if one would actually chas v'shalom here, one cannot do teshuva, that is definitely not an option to therefore just go ahead. It means maybe teshuva is very hard to do, maybe it won't be totally accepted, but he definitely made the wrong cheshbon over there. And finally, after his death, apparently Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yochanan eventually helped him get the din he deserved and brought him some kind of peace in Lasi Lavo. But in any case, it's a very interesting Mishnah which Elisha ben Avuya chooses to say over here. I don't think it so much really applies to him, because we said he was dedicated for Torah study from the time he was a kid. But it is an interesting Mishnah. It certainly applies to really, really obtaining and retaining Torah. So, Mishnah Chaf Hei, which in a real Mishnah would be Kaf, Elisha ben Avuya Omer. Elisha ben Avuya says, Halomed Yeled. Someone who learns, and the Mefarshim seem to say it means to begin, he begins to learn, he commences learning when he's a yeled, when he's young. L'mahu domeh, to what is he comparable? L'diyo kesuva al niyor chadosh. He's comparable, his learning is comparable to ink which is written on a new paper, on a new papyrus, I guess. L'omeh zokein, where someone who learns, or meaning begins to learn, most of his learning only comes when he is zakein, when he's elderly, when he's older. L'mahu domeh, to what is he comparable? L'diyo kesuva al niyor machuk, to ink which is written on erased paper. So it's interesting. I always pictured, you know, basically somebody had a paper and they wrote something and they didn't like what they wrote and they took an eraser and now there's a big smudge. That's why we tell the kids, you know, check that the eraser is actually functional before you use it, otherwise your paper just looks worse than it did before, etc. That's how I had always pictured it. When I looked at an interesting, rather fancy English translation, I came upon a new word from my vocabulary, and I'll share it for all of your vocabulary. You can send it into Reader's Digest. There is something known as a palimpsest. I hope I am pronouncing it right. Mrs. Adler probably has heard of it. A palimpsest is a papyrus or a parchment which was intentionally erased or scratched off so that they would be able to reuse it. So apparently what Elisha ben Avuya was referring to was not only stam somebody, you know, happens to erase something, there was a like cheaper paper, basically. We have, you know, deluxe printer paper and lower quality. So before they had paper, they had only parchment or papyrus, both of which were pretty expensive. And if you just wanted to write a shopping list, you didn't necessarily have to use brand new parchment. So they had this kind of second-hand parchment where they would scrape off or erase the earlier writing, and then they would write it. Actually, it's interesting. They would turn the paper to 90 degrees, so in case anything was left, it wouldn't confuse you as much. It would be like vertical, horizontal. And they would rewrite it over. And on that type of a surface, obviously, the ink did not stick as well. Also just won't look as clear, but it also wouldn't stick as well. If you ever look at a mezuzah or a Sefer Torah tefillin, the ink that we have to this day on cloth is slightly raised. I don't mean raised like Braille, but it's not really only sunk in. It has a shine, it has a gloss. So that won't stay as well if it's an already erased surface. It'll sort of scatter and just not behave as well. So in any case, this is the mashal that he used, which I guess in his day, as I say, apparently was a quite like understood thing. I always just thought it meant somebody took an eraser, but that's, I guess, that also. And Rabbeinu Yonah notes that this is not by any means meant to discourage one's learning when one is older. That is definitely not the point. Again, as we said, the main point is when one should ideally begin learning. Don't, you know, leave it to your golden years, it won't work as well. Because we have this concept of girsa de yankusa. The learning of one's young years is generally what sticks. And one knows it. One remembers, you know, the silliest songs, whatever one learned when one was young, one generally remembers that. Whereas something we learned yesterday possibly will not stick with us as well. We've had so many experiences and things over the years. It doesn't work as well. We're not a clean slate, as they say. That's basically the same expression, to start with a clean slate. And in fact, actually, I will just note that in school, one of our Kriya books, is the books for Hebrew reading for little kids, is called Girsa de Yankusa, learning when you're a little kid, because that's, I guess, reading is one of the first things you learn inside. In any case, in your Sidurim, you will see it says Chof Vav. In a real Mishnah, this actually is part of the same Mishnah, and it fits very well. You'll see why. But in the Siddur, it should be marked Chof Vav, 26. And we have another Tana, who I actually do not know much about. His name is Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda Ish Kfar HaBavli. So we mentioned last year that when it says Rabbi Yossi, when it says somebody's name, Ish Kfar HaBavli, a man from, in this case, Kfar HaBavli, it means he's like one of the Choshevah citizens. It's not just telling you where he lived, because after all, every Tana probably lived someplace. But when it says he's the man of such and such, it's like he was, I don't know, one of the, you know, board of trustees there, city council or something. He was the one in charge of this little place. Kfar is a village, so he was the main person in Kfar HaBavli, the Babylon village. I'm not sure where that is. It's possibly in Eretz Yisrael, but it was named after maybe people from Babel or something. So he says, until this point, we were talking about what age it is best for you to commence learning. Now we're going to be speaking about what age your teacher should be who is teaching you. Don't fire me yet. So it says, Abiyosi bar Yehuda ish kvar habavli omer, halomed mina ketanim. Somebody who learns from the little ones, meaning generally second to mean young people, lemahu dome, to what is he compared to? Leochel anovim kehos, to someone who eats unripe grapes, which are sour and not tasty. Veshose yayin migito, and somebody who drinks wine from its vat. He goes to his vat and he drinks it right away, which is obviously not aged wine, it's probably grape juice, I guess, at that point. Ba'alome bin azakenim, in contrast, somebody who chooses to learn from zakenim, lemahu dome, what may he be compared to? Le'ochel anovim b'shulos, to someone who eats ripe grapes, delicious, sweet grapes that are ripened. The shows a yayin yoshan, and somebody who drinks aged wine. So, again, definitely, clearly the recommendation over here is that somebody who's older is a better teacher, which we probably can understand, just inherently it makes sense. And the Mefarshim also explained from what Mishalim he chooses to use about the grapes and the wine especially. They say besides for new wine just not tasting as good as old wine, apparently, although I'm not anybody to speak about that, but apparently it makes a difference, as we know, if something is aged, whatever, 18 months, and I don't know, casks of something or another wood. It makes it much better. But besides for that, especially when people used to manufacture their own wine, the problem with drinking just now produced wine was that the dregs had not had time to separate and fall to the bottom. So you had very unfiltered wine, which might have, you know, been good in one sip, and the next sip you get a mouthful full of gross things in the, which are supposed to be in the bottom, but they're not in the bottom yet because you didn't give it time. So the nimshol for that, a lot of the mefarshim point out, is that a young person may have very good points that he has learned, but he hasn't yet totally absorbed them and sort of turned them into one whole. He may have learned this, he may have learned that, very interesting, important facts and different ideas, but they're still mixed in. They are perhaps mixed in with perhaps just mistakes. He hasn't learned everything. He thinks he knows X and Y, but he only knows X and Y. He still doesn't get it all. Or sfeikos. Rashi stresses that a lot, that a young person who has learned, let's say, you know, I don't know, somebody learned all of Shas, but he only learned it once, so he'll still have a lot of sfeikos. He'll have a lot of doubts. I think this is how we pass it. I'm not sure. I remember learning it, but, you know, really, do we do that? I'm not sure. Or I'm not sure how I was supposed to learn this, whatever. Especially back then when there was nothing written down, one really had to hear it from one's teacher numerous times to make sure one fully got it. And even now, there's no comparison to, you know, being in class than to reading somebody else's notes. Of course, it's always better to hear it from the teacher. And that is in generally taken what the problem is with having a young teacher. There'll be these impurities mixed in, and it will not be as satisfying for you to learn from such a person. Now, the next Mishnah, which in your Siddurim is hopefully marked Chav Zayin, continues, actually, as the same Mishnah in a real Mishnayos. Basically, there are three Mishnayos which are really one Mishnah, beginning from all the way from Chav Hei, Chav Vav, Chav Zayin. And you'll also see, I hope you'll see, in your Siddur that it says Rabbi Meir, but Meir is in parentheses. I hope that's what most Siddurim say. They should, because in the Mishnayos there's no mention of Meir. I don't know how Rabbi Meir managed to find his way into the Siddurim. Maybe somebody felt because Acher was mentioned, so a mention is Rabbi Meir. I have not a clue. Rabbi Meir is not in any Mishnayos you will look at. It is definitely Rabbi, who is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the famous redactor, the ultimate redactor of all of the Mishnayos, which again makes sense time-wise, because we're kind of getting to the end of the Tanoim, so Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi would fit nicely. And Rabbi Meir is in parentheses. In any case, whoever is saying this Mishnah, and it would seem to be Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, he disagrees. He disagrees with this Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda Ish Kfar HaBavli, and he disagrees. He says you can never tell. By the way, actually, some Mefarshim will take this as he's actually just kind of explaining Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda. He's not totally disagreeing. But most Mefarshim say he is disagreeing, because we'll see what he says. Rabbi Omer, Al Tistakel Bekankan, don't look at the bottle, don't look at the container, Ela B'Mashe Yeshbo. Rather, you should be looking at what's inside it. Yesh Kankan Chodosh Mole Yoshon, there could be a new bottle, but it's full of old wine. Somebody switched out the old wine from the old bottle into a new bottle for whatever reason. So you're saying, oh, this new bottle, I don't want this stuff. And inside there's delicious aged whatever it is. Or, v'yoshon sh'afilu chodosh ein bo. Inversely, or conversely, there could be an old bottle which not only doesn't have old wine, but it doesn't have any wine. And that's why they have colored bottles, so you don't realize it. You have to pick it up and take a look and see how heavy it is. But in any case, so Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi would seem to be disagreeing. He's saying, basically, overall, in general, don't judge by appearances. I mean, even besides for the issue of young or old teachers, this is a general statement also. In general, as we know, one should never judge by appearances. Get to know the person. Don't assume you know because he's this age, he's this stage, he's this type, he wears this, he looks like that, he is XYZ. Don't assume that. And in terms of teachers, Rabbi seems to be saying that, you know, it varies. It's true, I hear what you're saying, that older people are generally better teachers, but it's not necessarily so, because you're taking their age, like the battle. You're looking at the likelihood. I'm looking at what they actually have. There could be a younger teacher who has very much to share with you, and there could be an older teacher who not only is not Yayin Yoshon, but who actually has nothing to share with you, but is on a union on the Board of Ed and hasn't been fired yet and continues to teach. That's probably not what he said, but it could be either direction. So that's generally how we take it, that he's disagreeing. Some Mefarshim do say, actually, that he's not necessarily disagreeing. He's explaining that when Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda said somebody learns from Ketanim or Zakenim, Ketanim is a little bit of an unusual word to use for young people. Katan, if you're talking about age, it usually means literally a kid. Katan is not chayev mitzvah, so it means under bat mitzvah. You're probably not learning from somebody like that. If you want to say young people, so you say, you know, Yeladim, or Na'arim, or Bachurim, you could probably come up with more words, more Mishnaic words, but Ketanim is a little strange. Because Ketanim, besides for meaning literally a minor, a little kid, it also means a small person, like not such a great person, like Ketanei Amona, those of small faith. And Zakenim, as we know as Zakein, definitely, besides for just meaning a senior citizen, can mean Zeshekano Chachma, somebody who acquired the Torah wisdom at any age is considered a Zakein, like somebody you stand up for, etc. He's a Zakein. So in that view, then, Rabbi is not disagreeing. He's just saying that when Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda talked about Ketanim and Zakenim, don't think that he meant literally young and literally old. That may be how it generally goes, but don't assume. Ketanim means anybody who's small, who's small-minded, who doesn't have what to offer you. And Zakenim means Zeshekano Chachma, anybody who has a Chachma to offer you. It doesn't matter what actual chronological age he is. So we know Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, right, was worried because he was only 18, so he grew some white hairs, b'nais, that people would accept him. But had he not grown the white hairs, he would have been just as smart. He was worried how people would react. But obviously at 18, they felt he was ready to be a Nasi, Nasi B'Yisrael. So whether he's disagreeing or not, definitely the limit for us, and I mean, when it comes in terms of choosing a teacher, but also in general, one should not judge by appearances, one should give people a chance, and that would be the general gist of these three Mishnayos, which, as I say, they're three in the Siddur, but they actually really go together because they all relate to each other and they continue on. So I don't think we'll finish the parak, but we have time for one more Mishnah, which is a short Mishnah, and that is Rabbi Elazar HaKapar Omer. So it's an interesting name. I don't know what HaKapar means. It's not like Kaparo with Yom Kippur because it's spelled wrong. This is with a Kuf. Kaparo would be with a Kaf. It's probably a place name, I would assume, but I don't know. And apparently this Rabbi Elazar HaKapar, who was also one of the very late Tanoim, he was the father of somebody who was known as Bar Kapara. He was one of the early Amoraim, so they sort of straddled the divide between Tanoim and Amoraim. Bar Kapara, in fact, learned under Rebbe, which makes sense also. Rebbe is the very end of the Tanoim, so this Rabbi Elazar HaKapar was maybe like a contemporary of Rebbe, and his own son, Bar Kapara, is considered one of the first generation of Amoraim, and he learned under Rebbe. In fact, he was a very witty person. Rebbe wasn't always so thrilled with him. He made some jokes. Interesting stories of this person, of Rabbi Elazar HaKapar's son, who was called Bar Kapara. But this is Rabbi Elazar HaKapar, again, I suppose probably a place name, and he says something very fundamental. He says, Rabbi Elazar HaKapar Omer, Hakina, Vehatava, Vehakavod, Motziim es Ha'adam en Ha'olam. Jealousy and desire or lust and honor remove a person from this world. So, the Rambam explains that, you know, removing somebody from the world sounds kind of severe, so the Rambam takes it to mean that if somebody is not careful with his midos and he like falls into them without any regard to anything, he just falls uncontrollably into jealousy and lust and desire for kavod, he will eventually lack in emunah and mitzvos too, because he'll just be so entrenched in these things that he will not have time for anything else, and not only not have time, but he'll basically lose his faith. He will not anymore be interested in Ruchnias. Other Mefarshim also simply explain Motziim es Ha'adam mean it will lead to a lack of enjoyment in life. Like we say, you know, it'll give you ulcers. It'll take you out of this world, isn't it? It's not a pleasant life for someone to lead who's constantly beset by feelings of jealousy and desires that he can't meet and desires for honor, all these things that he can't really control, and he should rather try to work on himself if he keeps giving in to them and wanting more and more, so things just get worse and he will not enjoy life. And the Sforno says similarly, but back to Ruchnius a bit, he says these three have no like limitations at all. You can just pursue, if you're into them, there's no limit. You'll just end up, you know, worrying more and more and more and more about it. and this will prevent a person from achieving anything, from learning, from doing mitzvahs. He'll be too preoccupied with this stuff, and therefore motzi es adam min olam, he won't have achieved what he was meant to in this world. So we'll go through the three that are mentioned, and I think if one analyzes them, one will see that they basically cover almost all of the issues that one has in this world. Kina, so Rabbeinu Yonah, interestingly, brings a number of levels, even of kina. Which ones are the worst? Which ones are not as bad? He does the same for tava, other things. Basically, he says the worst thing is that not only do you want it, but you really hate that the other guy has it. I want it and he shouldn't have it. I'm like very upset that he has it. So that's the worst level. Somewhat less level, somewhat worse, somewhat less terrible level is if you're okay with that guy having it, but you know, I want the new car too, and so on. None of these things are good at all. They're just levels of not good midos. And then, but interestingly, Rabbeinu Yonah also mentions the concept we're aware of, kina sofrim. Kina sofrim tar b'chachma. If you're jealous of somebody else's Ruchnius or Torah achievements, you know, why can't I learn like he learns or something like that? So tar b'chochma, that generally leads to increased learning and knowledge because you want to beat him in color war when he quotes psukim, you want to have more psukim to quote, something like that. So what was interesting is that Rabbeinu Yonah mentions it. He says, okay, this is already like we switched from neutral to the good side, but we're not out of the woods yet. He says the ideal level would be for everyone just to do things lishma because they want to learn, because they want to increase their knowledge, not because this guy already knows more than I do. There's no reason for that. And in fact, we often say the, like, how do you know if you're really learning or doing anything? Lishma would be if you would be just as happy if somebody else would have done the same thing instead of you. Meaning, I had this great chiddush, and you know, the Rebbe looks at me, oh, wow, okay, I love learning. So what if your classmate had said it instead of you? It's the same chiddush, it's the same learning, right? Why should you care? I mean, kids are generally not on that level, and the idea of kina sofrim, like competitions and stuff, that's okay in general. I mean, today we have other issues, you can't make anybody feel bad, etc. That's a different pasha. But in terms of, you know, are we instilling, like, kina and so on? So it seems kina sofrim is acceptable, but it's not ideal. And the Gra brings examples. He notes that kina was one of the very early problems that led, we mentioned before, led to the Chet Adam Rishon. So as we see, kina played a very big deal. We know the Nachash was jealous of Adam having Chava, of different things. We see Cain was jealous of Hevel. Kina has a long, bad history. And others also mentioned Korach. Tava, that's also way back then. That's what led to the Eitz Hadas, v'chisa avahu lo'inayim. It's desirable. I like it. I want it. The Gra brings an example from Bilam also. We know Bilam was somebody who desired a lot. He said, imitain li balak melo beso kesef zahav. I would really like if Balak would give me, you know, the whole house full, and I still could say hey, but I won't go unless Hashem lets me. And Tava can refer to a desire for anything. It can be for money. They bring the example of a Gehazi who desired the money from Naaman and wrecked some things. And of course, also, generally what we mean by lust of Avera, Niyuf, inappropriate things, that sort of thing is Tava. And within things that are not like so terrible, like food, it has the best Hashgacha. But they also point out it'll be motzias adam in terms of it'll lead to illness. If you overindulge in anything, it's generally not a good idea. The Rambam famously says one should, you know, after a meal, one should still feel like a third hungry. One shouldn't eat until one's stuffed. So tava, this desire, I want, is never a good thing. The Gra brings Korach, actually, as an example of, I believe, the last one, Kavod. Kavod, this desiring Kavod, is also an unending thing. I heard, I'm not sure exactly from who said this originally, but they say a Kavod is, you know, something that's not tangible, it doesn't have a limit. So if you run after Kavod, you're never going to get it. It's just, you know, going to run. You're going to be more into it. It's going to run you out of this world. Again, example of Korach. Also, they point out Yeravam. Yeravam ben Nevat had such worries about his own personal kavod that if I let the northern tribes go up to Yerushalayim for Aliyah Regel, they might see that the Malchei Beis David are allowed to sit down and I'm not allowed to sit there, and they're going to return back to Yehuda. So I don't want that to happen. So you know what? I'll do a very simple thing. I'll set up Avodah Zarah, because that's much better than Chas v'sholom having any prisus of my kavod. So Yeravam Chata v'hechtias harabim led to Avodah Zorah. And also we'll just mention one thing from Parsha we read Bahaloscha a week and a half ago. We see that Harabonus mekaberes es be'olea, somebody who accepts Rabbanus, a position of importance with the idea to enjoy the kavod that comes out of it, he will not get that kavod. In fact, it'll do him in. We see that when Eldad and Medad were misnabim b'machane, so Yehoshua said to Moshe, that's totally not okay. Adoni Moshe kila'im, my master Moshe, we usually translate kila'im, put them in prison. He thought they were like crazy, you know, people saying nevuah. But another explanation is, do the kila'im, finish them off. So what does that mean? You kill them, chas v'shalom? No, so Chazal say, hatel aleihem tzorchei tzibur, give them some tzorchei tzibur position to be in charge of, v'hem kalim aleihem. They will dissipate, they will fall apart on their own. It is very, very, very hard to take care of Tzorchei Tzibur. We know that, it's brought down that Yosef was the first to die of his brothers, and this is just them. So, Kal v'chomer, if you add to that with the idea that I'm doing this because I want the kavod, where's the kavod, it'll really do one in, and that will be the end of that. And that's the Motzi Yenis Odom. So I don't want to end on such a negative note. I'll just end by thanking everybody who has appeared, and especially even those with faces, but also those with not. And Met Hashem, next week we will finish this perek. The last Mishnah is rather long, and then we'll start Perek Chamishi, which is very interesting. It's different numbers, as we know from when we read it. It's Asara and different tens, different numbers. Very interesting. Looking very forward to next week. And Met Hashem.